I'm Sam Clements, and welcome to this mini edition of the Picture House podcast. Today, I am joined by film director Pavel Pawlikowski, who has a new film out, Cold War. The film premiered in Cannes, and it got amazing reviews, really fantastic, glowing reviews. It was one of the few British-backed projects in Cannes this year, and I felt like a lot of UK critics were very excited and very supportive of it, which is fantastic. But the really great thing is the international critics also really got behind it, regardless of any sort of home advantage. And it was one of the talking points of the festival. It's a really beautiful black and white. It's shot in this Academy ratio, which is on a screen. It looks like a smaller square rather than the widescreen that we're often used to. And it really lets you focus on the characters' faces and like the symmetry of the screen. I'm aware that that sounds a little pretentious maybe, but it's true. I thought it looked amazing. It really got me. The star of the show has got two fantastic lead performances, and it's full of music. Music is so important in this film, and I loved hearing that sound in the cinema surround sound. And I got lost in this film for, it's a very tight runtime as well, it's about 85 minutes long, but I got really lost in it, and I had such a good time watching. I can't wait to see it again. It was a joy to talk to Pavel. He's such a legendary filmmaker. We're a big fan of Pavel at Picture House. We played Ida, and it was a huge success. It got lots of awards attention, which is great. But recently, I think as of last summer even, we played one of his earlier films, My Summer of Love, starring Emily Blunt, back before she was the Emily Blunt of, you know, before, at the very beginning of her career. And it was really nice to bring that film back and rewatch it on a big screen. Without further ado, I'll pass over to myself and Pavel to talk about Cold War, which is in cinemas now. It's a beautiful film, should be seen on a big screen, and that runtime is a gift. Enjoy! Thank you so much for talking to us today, Pavel. We're such a big fan of your films. I think I've worked at Picture House now. I was definitely here for the last one in 2013, I think, Ida. And we've recently, I think we brought My Summer of Love back as part of a retrospective.
Oh, great.
So we had that in cinemas last year. We were doing a big celebration of LGBT films and classification in the UK. A lot of people discovered it for the first time, which was so nice to hear. People seeing it on the big screen and talking about it and seeing that young Emily Blunt.
Yeah, she was a great performance. That one.
For our audiences, it's maybe been a few years since they last saw your name ahead of a feature. How was the development of Cold War? Was that something you knew you were going to do straight after Ida?
Yes, because I've been living with this story for many years, and I've been kind of humming and hawing, and how do I do it? It's very complicated. It's kind of inspired by my parents' complicated love life and exile and all sorts of twists and turns. So yeah, so that was like the kind of the love story everyone wanted to tell, but it seemed impossible until I made Ida, and then I realized that there's a way of making it without telling the whole story, just by withholding a lot of information, but just concentrating on strong scenes that are emotionally strong, that can be visually strong, that suggest all sorts of things, and that you can tell the story with gaps. And that the audience should be able to fill these gaps, you know, narratively, but also emotionally. You know, maybe not all the audiences everywhere, but there's enough audiences who can. So then I kind of jumped in, you know, not fully convinced it would work, but you know, that's the most exciting way of making films, that you don't quite know where it's going to work, because you're taking a slight gamble. And then to that love story, I added this musical element, you know, the folk ensemble idea, or this kind of universe that it creates, and the relationship between the main characters, who are both musicians of a different sort. So music becomes part of the relationship, and it defines the relationship, it defines changes in the relationship. It also reflects changes in society, because we start with very kind of basic roots music, and that becomes kind of turned into the folklore, gets turned into fake lore, very beautiful, but it's kind of like slightly faked up and orchestrated. Then that turns into jazz when we get to the 50s in Paris, and then we end up with some cheesy pop song from the 60s, which again kind of defines where we are with our heroine and a hero. So, you know, so the music became the third character in the film, and that helped me and gave me confidence to just kind of tell this story in this elliptical way, knowing that also the music will help to hold it together.
Absolutely. And I mean, music, a lot of emotion comes with the music. I certainly found what really struck me was how much I learned about music from this period watching the film. And I love seeing the evolution of this star as she's, you know, going on this journey.
Yeah.
How much about music did you know before going into this film, and was researching music part of your sort of, you know, pre-production and your work on the screenplay?
Well, no, I knew all the music before, you know. So I knew the music of this folk ensemble on which my folk ensemble, the fictitious one, is based, Mazowsze. I grew up with the music, not willingly, but they were surrounding my, you know, when I was a kid, they were on the radio all the time. It was a kind of officially state-sponsored people's music, so we hated it at the time. We'd rather listen to the Kinks or the Small Faces or something. But that was, yeah, what we were fed. Then I rediscovered, but some of these songs really stay with you, you know, like, you know, I remember hating ABBA in the 70s, whereas now when I hear Dancing Queen, it's a, you know, one of the tunes they had, actually quite fun, though. But it's the same with this folk music. I saw that folk ensemble, which haunted my childhood, I saw them live about 5-6 years ago, and it was absolutely mind-blowing, you know, the musically and the dance, the choreography was amazing, you know, and just seeing something in this virtual digital culture, but something that's so analog, that's so raw, and, you know, the bodies vibrating in space and the sound vibrating in space, it was really uplifting. So I really wanted to convey that in the film. And then I like folk, you know, like roots music, so I just spend a lot of time listening and traveling around local festivals in Poland looking for performers of folk music, and found some really good characters and good faces, you know, for the beginning of the film. And then jazz has always been my big passion, you know. I used to play myself, so especially that kind of cool, late cool jazz. So using certain tunes from this folk ensemble's repertoire and turning them into jazz numbers, you know, whether it's a kind of jazz chanson sung by Zula, or a bebop number for the saxophone and trumpet, you know, but it's the same tunes, but with a, you know, with another version. And it's a music, you know, bebop and cool jazz is something I've always loved. And a kind of kitsch, you know, kitsch pop music from the early 60s I love too, you know, this bio bongo, this kind of tropical number that Zula ends up singing. I mean, it's a really good bad music, you know, which we love these days, but it was kind of innocent and sweet, and compared to the kind of cynical stuff that, and kind of pre and computer generated stuff these days, you know, it's a bit of a relief, you know. So I think one of the attractions of the film is the liveliness of the music, and the naivety and the heart that goes into it.
Absolutely, it's infectious. I, you know, couldn't help but just sort of get involved in the music and tap along sometimes.
Very good. No, it was very funny. And in Cannes, you know, after this a few screenings, I wasn't there, but people were telling me that you had people walking around Cannes singing this Dwa Serduszka song, you know, the main tune of the film. Oi oi oi.
Yes.
Some Chinese people walking past and saying, oh, yo, yo. So it's really caught on.
That's where I saw the film as well, in Cannes. Uh-huh. And I exactly the same thing for the next couple of days afterwards.
It was like stayed with you. Yeah,
it would come up at a party or something, talking about a different film, but then someone would do that and then they go, oh my God, have you seen Cold War? Which is really, it's great.
I'm happy. It wasn't, you know, I didn't quite realize how effective it would be. It was more like, you know, this would be good and I love this music and let's see how we can make it work. I had a very good collaborator, Polish musician, pianist, arranger, Marcin Masecki, who is a kind of a wonderful jack-of-all-trades adventurer, you know, who plays Chopin's nocturnes from memory, or plays Bach sonatas with his ears plugged, you know, to experience the feeling of going deaf, you know, like Beethoven was. And he plays with firemen's brigades, orchestras, you know, a bit like brass bands in the north of England. I mean, he just loves trying everything, you know. So when I suggested, why don't, you know, help me turn this folk stuff into jazz, you know, he just jumped at the opportunity and did a great job.
Wow, that's what a gift of a collaborator.
Yeah, but you know, wonderfully talented guy. I mean, it's just it's a real pleasure to see somebody like fly. You give him an idea and he just flies with it.
Another reason the film resonates is, you know, that as you said earlier, that people can relate to some parts of the story, maybe if they haven't had the same experience as the characters. I felt so invested in these characters by the end of, I think, 85 minutes runtime.
Yeah,
it was remarkable. Is that when you're writing, is it clear which bits can come in and which bits need to go out? out to keep it tight?
No, it's a process. You know, you usually at the beginning overwrite, then I never overwrite that much. I mean, the scripts tend to be like 60 pages, you know, unlike most scripts, which are 90 or 100 something. So I just kind of put the bare bones of the story, or the necessary bones of the story, and some dialogues and some, you know, twists and turns, and some, just imagine how it's going to be. Is it going to be a good film, good scene to shoot? Is it good for actors? Is it not over-explanatory? Does it give scope for the visual approach? Because I want everything to work as an image, and images, no? Images are very important and the strongest element. So you write that, then during the rehearsals or just meeting with the actors or even casting auditions, you constantly revise the script. You think, oh God, that was a bad idea, clearly, you know, so how else can I convey that? Or maybe it doesn't need to be conveyed, you know, maybe you just cut to the next scene. Or even when you go location scouting, you find a location, actually, that, you know, in this location I could tell it so much more simply and no need for all this kind of approach play. And throughout, and even during filming, you cut stuff out where you realize, you know, it kind of worked in rehearsal, but it feels like dead wood because the film has already got its own character and it seems to be functioning anyway. You know, maybe you don't need a scene, you know. So it's the, you know, the beauty of being the writer and director, not being precious about the script, is that the film, you follow the life of the film, you know, it becomes like a documentary working on, you know, and sculpting away. And you can just, I never carry the script with me, you know, I just kind of remember the good bits from the scene and then just treat it naively like, let's just shoot this the best way possible now with this light, you know, with this mood and with what we know from previous weeks of filming, you know, let's not be, sometimes actors, yeah, but I said that stuff and I did this, and I'll forget about it. This was then, and it's gone dead now, that stuff, you know, let's just keep it fresh and keep sculpting away. So it's a kind of never-ending sculpting process, not even writing, it's more like sculpting, because the image and the movements of people and camera are as important as, you know, and you forget what's on paper, you know?
That sounds like a really exciting way to make a film, and also to keep it fresh, as you say, as you go along.
It's scary to the producers and, you know, and to the crews, you know, because we'd worked together with my two producers, Tanya and Eva, and Tanya produced My Summer of Love, Eva produced Ida, so they already know how I work, so they gave me a lot of elbow room to kind of keep going this way, you know. And actors, after, you know, initial shock, you know, they're also kind of started kind of not worrying too much about, you know, but I didn't say that line and I had this wonderful scene which you cut and I've been so looking forward to performing it. And it's like, I mean, we had a lot of that, but slowly, you know, they kind of, okay, well, this is the nature of the beast, and you know, if it works on screen later, then everyone forgives you.
The cast in this film are so good, especially your two leads. Yeah. I was wondering, how did you go about casting them? Did you have them in mind when you were writing?
I had Joanna in mind because I'd worked with her before. I knew her personality, which I love. I mean, she's a very special kind of creature, incredibly honest, straightforward, spontaneous, fun. She's got this cinema charm, you know, so I've always wanted to do something big with her, you know. And having said that, when I was thinking of her, writing and imagining, and I was thinking of her like 10 years ago when I first met her, you know, I met her doing a kind of initial cast for Ida 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And she wasn't right for Ida at all, for all sorts of reasons, but she stayed with me, so now when I needed Zula to be, well, I needed Zula to be really young at the beginning, like 17, so like a really fresh kind of peasant who just turns up, whereas Joasia was no longer that girl that I met 10 years before, so I then kind of reinvented the character, added, you know, 7 years to her life to make it more believable, gave her a past, you know, some kind of vaguely criminal past, as you know, and suddenly it was fine, you know, she's a bit older, you know, that's not a problem. But she was definitely there in my mind. I kind of knew there's Joasia who can do this sort of thing, and she's got a great voice, and we can expand her voice, you know. I tried her out singing in a more kind of smoky, jazzy way, which she'd never done before. She could do that. She then sang with Mazowsze, with this folk ensemble. So, again, totally different voice, you know, and that worked too. So for her, it was a wonderful challenge. You know, she loved that bit. And then she learned to dance, which wasn't so straightforward because she had to, you know, it was very precise choreography with this ensemble, you know, so it took a bit of, I mean, she spent half a year going there and learning to dance. But she definitely was, you know, was there from the beginning as a kind of possible lead. With Tomasz, he came a bit later because for a long time I was hoping to cast a non-actor who's just a great musician to have these kind of musical scenes happening for real, you know, like in a documentary. But it's very difficult to find somebody who's both a performer, you know, musical performer and actor. In fact, this is how I met Masetsky, you know, the Marcin, the my musical collaborator, because I thought maybe he can act.
Yeah.
And he couldn't act. But that's how we met, you know. But basically, I also needed somebody who has the aura of a kind of pre-war male, you know. So who's like Gregory Peck, you know, that kind of, you know, type, and who's not like most actors today who are either kind of pretty faces or kind of yobs, you know. I mean, it's very difficult to find leading men these days, you know. So he was he never played that kind of thing before, and people didn't treat him in Poland or didn't see him as a kind of looker, you know, as a good looking guy, because you never, you know, usually kind of become somebody else. And whereas here, you know, we really went for that, you know, this kind of matinee idol look, but plus a kind of talented guy with problems, you know, and who changes when he goes abroad, who's no longer the guy he was back in Poland. So, but there was a bit more casting, you know, kind of, but they're not that much, because there aren't that many actors in that ballpark, you know. So, and then, you know, it took a bit of time to get chemistry between them. They both like each other a lot. They're both good, really good actors, you know, but how do you create chemistry if you have two sensitive souls? It's not easy. Very married to their to their spouses, you know. So that took time, but it you know, but we did have time, because the film took half a year to shoot, you know. I mean, with breaks, of course, but it was like a 7 month shoot, I think, overall. So we had time to kind of for them to become a couple, and for the whole crew to become a great family.
On screen, it's electric between the two of them. They've got this really fantastic relationship. And did you have time, like specific time for rehearsals, just for those two to get to know each other and to break down those barriers, as you're mentioning?
You know, I did my best. You know, I wanted to send them to a dance lesson so they kind of just got familiar with each other's bodies and stuff. You know, they were a bit miffed by my approach, so I had to kind of like lay off a bit and just hope, let's see how it works. Time is a great sculptor, you know. In terms of script, in terms of relationships, in terms of everything. So the film had a kind of a life of its own, and it took a bit of time, but everything slowly came together.
Both of them look so good in the black and white, and their faces especially. Like, I was so captivated just looking at the intricacies of, you know, lines and whatnot on their faces. Was this always something that you'd shoot in black and white?
No, at the beginning I was thinking of doing it in colour, because I didn't want to repeat myself, and, you know, and why not in colour? But then I couldn't find the right colour for Poland of the, you know, the early 50s, which wasn't really very colourful. So all colour would be kind of arbitrary. I mean, Poland was kind of grey, brown, green, maybe. And then we kind of fiddled with possibility of shooting it in kind of technique, like a Soviet version of Technicolor, which was quite fun, kind of saturated and very washed out at the same time. So, but that felt very mannered, you know, so that wasn't, you know, I mean, the most honest and straightforward way was doing it in black and white. It's clearly a period film, you know, black and white is a clear deal with the audience now. I just wanted to make it a kind of glamorous black and white, you know, not a bit more contrasty, more punchy than Ida, you know, and use key lights, especially in Paris, you know, where the light really hits her face, you know, and his face. And then, which, you know, how do you make black and white as colourful as possible? That was a challenge, you know.
It's just true that the frame is always full of lots of, you know, interesting things and interesting details, and it feels like the black and white actually focuses your eyes on especially people's costumes, and there's lots of really great like suits and dresses which really work.
Well, you look at what's essential, or you highlight what's the essential things.
I used to be a projectionist in a former life.
Yeah,
I love that you shot this in your Academy aspect ratio.
Yeah,
well, I think 1:37. What's the thinking behind that?
For me, it was not a very exotic ratio. You saw the documentaries, and they're all kind of that, you know, they're on 16mm, but not super 16. So that was the kind of frame you worked with, you know. And I like limiting the field of vision, you know, just suggesting a lot through sound what happens out of the picture. You know, it's kind of, it's a useful tool to have. But here we move the camera, you know, so sooner or later you discover other things, but at the right time, you know, so you play with the expectations of the audience or with the urge to see. So there wasn't much thinking, it just felt right. But we didn't want to do this kind of bizarre framing with Ida, with a lot of headroom, you know, which had a kind of reasons, very good reasons in Ida, but here would have been very fake. And also when you move the camera with that kind of framing, it's kind of absurd. But we did a lot of the time, we raised the camera a bit higher to have things happening in the background, you know, to reveal the landscape behind the heroes, you know, so there's a bit more background elements.
It's a really fantastic window into this world, and I look forward to playing it in our cinemas.
Very good.
Thank you very much, Fevel.
Take care. Thank you.